So my dad, you know, I haven't been able to find a lot of pictures of my parents, and I remember this beautiful picture of my dad in his military uniform. He was an attaché to the British, so he had one of the beautiful British hats and the kind of jackets the British Air Force had. And when he would come, after he came back from the war, he would come to pick me up at school, and all the little girls would go, "Oh, Robin's daddy is so handsome," and run out to see him. And but he was really, you know, he was a poet. He was a wonderful storyteller. He was a beautiful artist, and his mother was also an artist who had attended the Art Students League as a young woman and was quite an adventurous. Not such common things in the South at that time. And he really, you know, he went in as a private. He enlisted as a private, and because he didn't want them to discover that he had a college education. They discovered that he had a college education. He was trained to be a lawyer, so they made him an officer. And then he really suffered because he was responsible for the lives of a group of men who were cleaning up the explosive devices that were left buried when the Nazis, when the German army left. And they were, you know, trying to build, taking these explosives and sometimes using them to clear land to build airstrips. And he found himself ahead of the regular army on the morning, on the night before D-Day, defusing buried explosives on the beaches with his men, and wondering at any moment who he was going to lose or himself. And then all through the thing, way out in front, ended up with attached to the Russians when they were finally breaking through. If you know the story of the German army in Russia, it's one of the really horrible parts of the war. And his so the Germans and the Russians have always hated each other. And so his job was to translate for German officers and German soldiers and try to save their lives, because the Russians were, they weren't just killing them, they were killing them in very imaginative, awful ways, and not letting them surrender. And they had reason for their anger. So he went through all of that, and he came back very wounded. And he had he really had a lot of personal resources, and he was very whimsical, and he told beautiful stories. And so this is where a lot of my love of fairy tale and myth and magic and poetry comes from. All kinds of stories, both out of his personal experiences, you know, always change slightly for a child, but he talked to me a lot. We spent a lot of time together. And he encouraged my drawing. He, in a time in the South when you didn't say things like this to a little girl, he told me I could be anything I wanted to be. And we traveled a lot. We went to different parts of the country. And when I got older, I was surprised to find out that people didn't always think that little girls could be anything they wanted to be. It was really a bit of a shock.
Are there any veterans of World War II or the Korean War in here? I noticed there's some senior citizens.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
We honor you.
Yeah.
We honor you.
World War II in front of you.
Yeah. 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 It's, you know.
Those of you who have studied the history of World War II know that the Normandy Beach and D-Day was really horrendous. I have been through this myself, by the way, in the military. They landed out of those LST, landing ship tanks and personnel carriers, with probably 85 pounds on their backs and their uniforms in maybe 5 feet of water, maybe 6 feet of water, and with withering enemy fire going right over their heads. Many, many, many people didn't survive, and Robin's dad was one of the ones who did.
When I was 8 or 9 years old and living on, my dad was, at that time he was a lawyer for the Army, trying to catch all the companies that were cheating the Army, the whole case of the horrible, the cheap boots that went to Korea and all the boys had frozen feet. He was the lawyer that tried, that in many cases succeeded, but not always, in nailing the companies that did that. A lot of that kind of stuff. And I would go around with him sometimes on his trips to investigate these things. And I would say at that time, Probably as a child, not entirely knowing what I was saying, but knowing it was somehow true to my friends whose dads were all professional military. None of them ever came home. Our dads, they're here, but they didn't come home. You know, it's like nobody comes home from a war. And that was my feeling at that time. I think he did an amazing job, actually, of coming home. But I've just been recently told maybe the thing in my lungs is something that's left over from that. You know, he smoked and smoked and smoked, and sometimes he got drunk and disappeared. But he never acted anything out on the family. He always came back and was there, you know.
I've treated, as a psychologist, psychotherapist, probably between 2 and 3 dozen Holocaust survivors. They gravitate towards me. And let me tell you, what I have learned is that the wounds of war don't just stop with the people who are in it. They go on for generation after generation after generation. They become part of the social body, and they are built into us. And so the very cough that Robin has now, she never smoked, but she thinks she got it crawling around on the floor of a man who was damaged by World War II. And So we both acquired head injuries. She fell down the stairs at 4 or 5 in the South, and then fell off horses. And I had a number of really devastating, should have been deadly, climbing falls and motorcycle accidents and being in martial arts events. And so these things do leave their legacy. By the time that we met and married in October 1964, and by the way, we're about to celebrate our 50th a little later this year. both university students in New York. I was at Columbia, Robin at NYU. We were both slightly crazy from our head injuries, and we decided to enter Jungian analysis. And I was to enter analysis with Edward C. Whitmont. Anybody here know him or analyzed with him? Wonderful, wonderful man. And tell that story a little bit. Christopher, we called him, just barely escaped by the skin of his teeth from the Nazis. He can remember being in Vienna when the Anschluss came, and Austrians were divided and torn by that unbelievable thing. Of course, they're German-speaking, and here came Hitler, and everybody was going Heil Hitler and sticking their hands up in the streets, and neighbors were divided against neighbors, and horrible things were done against Jewish people who you lived right next door to and in Vienna. And it was just, I mean, talk about horror stories. go to the Discovery Channel and look at some of the stories of World War II if you want to get sober, and then do something nice for yourself a little bit later, or process it. But lots and lots of trauma. Christopher had a love of mountains, and I think that was one of the things that attracted me to him after I heard him lecture at the Jung Foundation, 1963-64. Whitmont's first published book, The Symbolic Quest, and I had some of my most, this is a young woman who had whose father had died, who I knew that she was getting better when she did this beautiful mandala in the sand tray. And Christopher introduced me to sand play as an extremely valuable form of therapy. The very first dream that I presented to him in analysis was that I was somehow imprisoned in a device made of thorns. And if I made one wrong move, a thorn on a spring would come forward and pierce my heart. And it wasn't until about 20 years later, studying shamanism in depth, that I came upon this image, and I said, yeah, that's it. It's exactly like it. It's an archetype. And you can see the rapt concentration on this Aboriginal man's face. And so when I presented that dream to Christopher, he said, yeah, now the fun begins. He had a very droll way about going through all these things. But I value him so much as an analyst, and I worked with him over 25 years, just about as long as I worked with Joseph Campbell, not continuously, because when I went to teach college upstate, we parted, and then I came back and was trained by him as a psychotherapist. Christopher would say, don't ask me how to lead your life. Let's look to the dreams. Let's look to what boils up from inside you for guidance. And it was infallible. And he could read those dreams extraordinarily. He was also a master prescribing homeopath who cured me of a terrible malaria-like illness I came back from Mexico with. Let's look at the symptoms, your unique set of constellation of symptoms or a constellation of symptoms. And I'll tell the story real quickly because I don't want to take too much time. But I'd come back from Mexico with this terrible infection in my bowels. And every 3 weeks, I would get 104-degree fever and diarrhea and vomiting and sweating all over. And then it would go away again, and my life would sort of return to normal. So I complained about it in therapy. And he said, tut, 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 tut. Why didn't you tell me sooner? I said, I thought you were a Jungian analyst, you know, a regular doctor. And he came, when he listened to my symptoms, he went into a back room, came out with a little white powder, put it on my tongue. And as I left the office, he said, oh, it will probably recur tonight. And I said, it can't, Dr. Whitman. It's regular as clockwork every 3 weeks. And it just passed, and I'm feeling shaky, but it's over. He said, tut, 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 tut. And then he said, and it probably will, you probably won't have an actual fever. Now, call it placebo or hypnosis, but that night the fever returned. I was shaking, sweating, going through everything. I said, Robin, give me a thermometer. Stuck the thermometer in my mouth, 98.6, gone, never to return. Now that is wizardry. That he is a master, was a master prescribing homeopath. And Sigmund Freud said, stay away from those big neurotic babies we call our patients. Carl Jung said, every successful analysis turns into a friendship. And this is during a series of seminars we did at our place, Stone Mountain Counseling and the Center for Symbolic Studies, at a dream seminar training for professionals.
People loved it. People loved it, and they came back the next year and wanted another. And we're so glad we did them, you know, because a lot of people that we know, we wanted to share him with them, and they would never have gotten to meet him. And now, you know, we have our own dream groups, and some of those people got to meet him. It was nice.
So ain't she beautiful?
So, Columbia, South Carolina. I was in the South, May Day, Beltane, and the Cross Quarter Festivals were observed. Of course, not knowing, most people had no idea that they were pagan and ancient and, you know, went back deep and not only into British and Gaelic cultures, but actually there are echoes and reflections of them all around the wider temperate belt of the world, all up into Scandinavia and down far south. There are the horse dances and the all kinds of things like maypoles, all sorts of things of this sort. So I was one of little May Queens chosen in parks all over the place and then in schools all over the place and then all over the state. Each city would have a May Queen and then there would be one queen. And that sort of led later on, I think, to sort of Miss America type things is my own personal theory. But it wasn't they weren't chosen for beauty. They were chosen for all kinds of reasons, you know, the appropriateness. But there was really a Beltane festival. And not only, and this is, we're going to come back to this later, but not only was May Day an ancient festival celebrating the maiden queen and the whole thing, but a lot of it is about the animals and really is anchoring the community. And this is what shamanism does. The community comes together and celebrates these various rituals, and the shaman is the experiencer who's at the core of it, the one who's been there and seen that and can speak with authority about the world of spirit and be the messenger. One shaman said to us, well, the shaman is like a plumber. When things go wrong between the worlds, he comes and fixes the pipes between the world of spirit, the world of the divine, and the human world. And the human world is a community world. And so these festivals are set us in place in the community. And we'll go back.
So while I got into analysis, it's not uncommon for it to become a family affair. And Christopher's office mate on the Upper East Side was this wonderful, brilliant young analyst named Anne Belford at the time, and she was to marry Barry Ulanoff, a Union theological professor. Wonderful, wonderful man. We became good friends later on. And she is now still the Christine Brooks Johnson Memorial Professor of Psychiatry and Religion at Union Theological. If you live near New York, go take a seminar with her.
Yeah, yeah. She's right up your alley, really. And she'd be a wonderful speaker. So what took me into Anne's office was a specific dream, and we're coming to the end of this. I was a graduate student, and I was struggling with all of this magic and art and love of myth and all this stuff, and then being in New York at a time when art was being as secular as it could possibly be, because it didn't succeed. It was always, things were always slipping in under the covers, and they happened even in art classes. But you know, it was a hard time, and I was really trying to be clear-headed and out there, and nobody thought anything about fairy tales. And then I had this dream in which, it's a very dark dream, there is this black being in the body of a sort of a slender, skinny woman with huge fingernails, like knitting needles, and her mouth was bloody. This is an image that has come up. I've seen it a lot in dreams since. And was she bleeding? Was she eating blood? It was a terrifying image, and the feeling of the dream was terrifying. And I took that to Anne.